Amber Love. Welcome to another episode of Vodka O'Clock from AmberUnmasked.com. You can pick up my mystery novels from the Sarah Weathers Mystery Series. The first one is Cardiac Arrest, the second one is Full Body Manslaughter, and the third one, Miscarriage of Justice, will be out sometime this year. So you can find out more at AmberUnmasked.com or just go to Amazon or Barnes & Nobles and you should be able to find them. You can also sponsor my work and, you know, things like the effort it takes to make this show at patreon.com/AmberUnmasked. So joining me today, back on the show, he was here quite a while ago, is author and dear friend of mine, Thomas Pluck, if you are looking up his books, while we discuss his latest book, Bad Boy Boogie, from Down and Out Books, and we're just going to talk about the writing process and all that other kind of stuff. So hopefully there won't be any major spoilers, but we're going to get into the details of the book a bit. And some of that does include some violence and sexual violence, so just consider that a warning. So Tom, welcome back.
Well, it's great to be back. Love talking with you.
So yeah, this is, I mean, we talked quite a while ago, but we talk on Twitter all the time. We've had an interesting week, year so far. In 2017, here in America, it's been interesting. So I have done a lot more reading in order to try to ignore the world. But then this past week, I basically, like, you know, worked on my stuff and then turned on C-SPAN for the other half of the day, and pretty much drove myself insane. So I've read a lot more books this year than I did last year. And Bad Boy Boogie just totally blew me away because I've read some, you know, hardcore noir books, you know, from other friends of ours with violence. And this book was, even with the violence that's in it, I called it smooth. I'm like, the transitions from scene to scene are smooth. Nobody feels too unbelievable. Like, you have all these different characters from New Jersey, and you have this prison scenes. So you've got, like, trans women in the book, and you've got these, you know, burly, toxic, masculine men in the book. And then you've got, you know, of course, the main girl. You know, we will talk about, like, what it takes to have Ramona be who she is, too. So give the little elevator pitch about the book, about Bad Boy Boogie.
Well, the tagline that I've been doing now is, you know, the saying that it's like that Jay DeMarteau spent 25 years in prison for killing a brutal rapist and bully, and all he learned in there was how to get away from it.
Yeah, so 25 years in jail from...
But, you know, a little more, the synopsis, you know, which gives a little bit more. I mean, that's like the movie tagline thing.
Yeah, that's the elevators, you know, you have 10 seconds to talk to somebody pitch. But,
more detail, I would say, is that when Jay DeMarteau steps out of prison after 25 years for murdering a vicious school bully, he tries to follow his convict mentor's advice, which is that the best revenge is living well. But questions gnaw at his gut. I mean, he's been in prison for 25 years. It's like, where have his folks disappeared to? Why do his old friends want him gone? And who wants him dead? So he teams up with his high school sweetheart turned legal Valkyrie, who's Ramona, which you spoke of, friend Tony, who's a body shop owner, and Raina, who's a razor-wielding gentleman's clubhouse mother, who's based on people I knew and in my past. And with them, he'll unravel a tangle of deception that goes all the way back to the bayous where he was born in Louisiana. So that's the short synopsis I can give you.
So the first thing that I wanted to mention, though, of course, was that you chose to set it in real locations like Nutley, New Jersey, and that area around there. Why did you just decide to go with real towns instead of making up towns?
I find it much easier to use places that I've been. I am inventing it, or, you know, basically making it an amalgam of other different towns. But this one, when I was inspired by the story, it was on several news events and stories that happened in the area. And I felt, growing up, and the fact that we do flashback to Jay's childhood with his friends, which I spent in Nutley. And those scenes really drew on my growing up in my own childhood. So it felt like I wanted to, you know, enjoy a little bit of the nostalgia there. And actually, this one, even though I've had Blade of Dishonor published before this, this was the first book that I wrote. And it was, it's the one where you just put your whole heart in. And that is, that's where I came from and grew up, and this area that I know well. And I wanted to try and tell a story that could only really, it couldn't only happen here, but in certain, some ways it could. the details is really make it a Northern New Jersey story.
Yeah, because even though there was some, like you mentioned, some scenes and time spent in the Louisiana bayou of Jay's family, like biological family and stuff, it's very this suburban, outside the metro area of New York kind of a story. And what's interesting is obviously noir is a very broad category, and crime fiction itself is even broader. But I think so many people think of New York City and Los Angeles and Philadelphia that, to have something that's just as dirty and ruthless, and it's like right here in this happy little suburb.
I don't want to take credit for that. There's a lot of people who've been writing in this in the suburbs as well, say like Megan Abbott, but because the way the book industry is, I think they're calling hers domestic suspense, because domestic, because
she's a woman.
And the other is the, there was, after Gillian Flynn, Gone Girl, there was a, big research. There's all these women writing, these dark stories. It's like, the people in the fandoms and the genres, who enjoy the genres have known about them. They've been doing this since the beginning, but, every couple of years the news finds it again. And I have, no problem playing in the same wheelhouse. It's like there are men who write in the same area. But it's usually not quite as dark. Harlan Coben is probably the most famous writer who writes in our area. And his are more thriller, family, disrupted by an outside source, it's almost, I won't say Ozzy and Harriet, but like the struggling suburban family, and they're just being bothered by all these things outside. I love them, but, there's dirty stories, there's people in the working class and the underclass in our areas as well. And I wanted to something, get all three, the affluent, the middle class and the working class, a story that really told how we're all fighting each other out here in Jersey.
Yeah, it's a pretty blended town. But yeah, shout out to Megan Abbott. There's a new comic book coming out by her and Allison Galen, illustrated by Steve Scott, called Normandy Gold. So I have details on the website about that.
I can't wait to read that either.
Yeah, I don't know if that's her first foray into comics or what, but it's the first time I noticed her name in comics. But anyway, you were talking about all these different, the diversity of what is, even in the suburbs, which is one of the things that I took away from the story, was that you've got it in that sort of, it's not really, mafia-ish, but it was like sort of like the kids' version of mafia, where you've got like the Irish kids and the Italian kids and, like who's friends with who and, then Jay, what?
So that's, don't let me interrupt you, go on.
And then Jay comes out of nowhere and here's this kid with this, hick bayou accent and stuff, so.
The fish out of water story is always fun, and that's partly, I'd been in love with Louisiana for a long time. My wife's from there, but I actually was of the state before I met her. This is some writers who wrote down there, like James Lee Burke and, Confederacy of Dunces, and even Justin Wilson, the cook on, who was on PBS, the Cajun chef. I remember hearing him when I was a little kid, and that was, I was always into, what is this place? And so that's why Jay ended up being from there. I wanted to inject a little flavor, and it makes it, it's always easier to see things as an outsider, because we're living in that water. When we grow up in the suburbs or in, these towns where you don't really question the pecking order of, you know, hey, how come these kids hang together and the other ones don't? Even, you know, even if let's say they're a diverse group, and then you start realizing, oh, okay, they grow up on one side of the tracks. You know, they're a little more blue collar, and these kids are a little more, you know, a little more refined. They're wearing preppy shirts, and you know, and you start, and from the outside, it's easier to see how the groups come together, and that's why I wanted to give it, you know, to have Jay come up from there.
Yeah, so Jay's little gang when he's a teenager is sort of like the misfit kids, I guess, didn't really fit in with anything else, because like there's the Jewish kid who hides his yarmulke under his baseball cap, and you know, and he's picked on for that reason, and like it seems like everybody in this book was abused in some way, shape, or form, and then Ramona is, like I said, the leading female character, and she is, you know, comes from a much wealthier class, and then she marries an even wealthier class, and yet she's has a typical teenage existence. Like, you know, she was fooling around with adult men when she was a teenager because she's like, who gives a crap? That was one of the things about Ramona, was like, whatever. She's like, I'm going to do whatever I want to do.
Well, I mean, it's another one who's, I mean, maybe not everything that happens to her is based on, well, I know, but the character is definitely inspired by, let's say, I mean, I don't like the term precocious, you know, but let's say the two have as a friend who went to college at a very early age, and you feel, you get that confidence in yourself when you're young, and you're, you know, you think, oh, well, look, I'm, you know, I'm an adult. You know, we all kind of felt like that. We don't really know that we don't have it together yet, and we can't make these decisions.
Right.
You know? And that was, you know, where she came from. It's not, you know, trying to be salacious or anything. It's just, you know, these are, you know, people that I knew. And she, it's like, when I came to, when to write her story, it was like, okay. It's like, I've never lived as a 16-year-old, you know, girl in high school, but I, yeah, know the stories of a lot of women who did. So that's where I drew from.
Yeah, and she's, it was very, like, this is why every character felt really developed, you know, especially, like, by the time you get to the end, you really know everybody so well. And even though people may question the actions of somebody like Ramona, she did things that definitely were by her own choice, because the one time somebody tried to make her do something, she stood up for herself and was just like, you know, and then Jay took care of it too. And that was when they were much younger, you know, teenagers. But it was just an interesting thing where it's, you know, she like, she, it's not that she didn't know the difference between right and wrong. And I think a lot of people lose that when they talk about teenagers and sexuality, that, oh, they don't know any better. They don't know this. And, oh, you know, if she was a teenage girl and this man was, you know, an adult, he should, you know, she should know better. And it's like, but she definitely knew right from wrong. She just made her choices as to, no, not this one, you know, that one time.
Yeah, I didn't want to give her, you know, I don't like when, you know, people, are given a pass, and you know, I think that, you know, we're going to, yeah, you make people, we're going to, our life is our decisions, and sometimes you're going to make wrong ones. People are going to behave selfishly. They're going to behave vindictively, yeah, and there's things we can't undo. And, I mean, you can, you know, if you want to tally them all up like we're Anubis at the afterlife, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I wonder how many of us would pass the test. And that was the thing in there. I mean, it's like she, you know, the character, you know, yeah. She is looking out for her, you know, not her own, you know, not her own interests. She has her own plan. Yeah. You know, there's so many women characters, especially if they're married, where you start seeing that, you know, like they don't seem to have their own agency. Yeah. And, yeah.
And she definitely does. I mean, she might not be.
And this is, yeah, exactly. It's like the whole plot is actually revolves around stuff that she put into motion.
Yeah. And you might not like it. Like it, that's the thing. Like anybody who reads it, you might not like it. You might not like what she does, but you still respect her that she's in control of herself.
Yeah. Well, part of it, I mean, this wasn't not just her, but every character. We make we make decisions. And this may say more about me, or at least the people I grew up with, is, you know, there's going to be, you know, even stuff that comes from, you know, altruism. There, a lot of times it goes through a lens or a filter where it's like, well, you know, how much can I do the most good for everybody, including myself and my friends? You know, it's like, you know, how many people, you know, they really go out and do, you know, selfless, you know, things, or, you know, oh, I'd like to help this out. And, you know, of course I get some, you know, feedback or, you know, publicity on it or whatever. So it's not to say that everyone is, you know, I'm not super cynical either, but, you know, everyone has their own little agendas in it. And when you have characters who seem to be doing things, you know, just to help the, you know, just to help the protagonist, you know, they don't really have that, I don't think they're fully human. You know, even Toadies, you know, was it Tony in the book? We didn't mention him yet. He's Jay's best friend who runs a body shop.
And he really does help him out when he gets out of prison.
He does, yeah. But, yeah, of course, he has his own reasons as well. And it's not, you know, he's not, you know, I don't want to get too deep, you know, I don't want to give away too much, but he has his, you know, it's similar. Everyone, you know, everyone's using Jay a little bit. And that's, yeah. Sorry, go on.
Well, Jay is, I felt for him, even though it's like, you know, this dude is like so violent and he does not regret the murder that he committed that sent him to jail. He gives zero fucks. Like, that's just, but the time period of in the 80s to go away for 25 years and come back, he's like, he doesn't know what a cell phone is. He doesn't know how to use the internet. He's so confused and lost. And it's like, it's not only because they're adults, but because he literally lost time. You know?
Oh, yeah, he was supposedly, you know, it was like between 15 and 16, let's say, when he was arrested. And in reality, I mean, unless you're extremely rich, and a case like this, you're not going to be walking free again unless you are acquitted. And Jay obviously was not. So he was, you know, that was the last time that he, you know, saw his family freely or anything. And to me, it was just like, I'd like to write a story about a guy who gets out of prison, doesn't even know how to drive. You know, I'd read certain stories about, you know, people who've been in, you know, from juvenile times and the difficulty they have in reentry. This story is only partly about that. But I couldn't ignore the realities of it. And it's not, yeah, but on the other hand, it's not, I don't spend too much time on Jay looking at a cell phone and saying, oh, what is this magic, you know, what is this sorcery? No, it's like you're aware of cell phones in prison. I mean, they are smuggled in. You don't get to use one every day. I mean, you've probably never seen an iPhone, you know, but the flip phones, right, they get smuggled in, and you read about certain things in the internet and whatnot in the magazines you pass around. But it is a totally different world, but the people really don't change. And that's another thing in it, is how he gets along, is that he, you know, having both dealt with, you know, as a kid with a bunch of manipulative people, both friends and family, and then in prison where you're constantly pushed between, you know, different gangs and different, you know, different actors. You have to keep the COs happy, but you can't, you know, there's certain things you can do and cannot do in there. He is a very quick judge of character and what people's motives are. And that's what he uses against people more than being a mechanic. You know, he also learned in prison, you know, he spent his time in every training course he could find that they would give him. So he's pretty good with a wrench and everything, but more so he, you know, can view people and he gets a good read on what their intentions are.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple.
Yeah. And the prison gangs, like, I mean, you really, I was wondering what kind of research you did, or if it's just because you're so well read on your own, this information that you have on all of this prison stuff. I mean, if it doesn't come from a TV show, then I'm literally clueless. So,
well, Oz, you know, it's not bad. It's not bad to that, but for me, someone was I read the Angolite, which is the official inmate-run newspaper of Angola. Louisiana prison, which anyone could subscribe to. It's like $25 a year. And these guys, they write good articles in there. They're mostly involving the criminal justice system. So if you're not interested in that at all, may not be. It may not be the magazine for you, but it gives you a look into prison life. The gang stuff is more from reading people who had served in prison, everything from the original Orange is the New Black to, God of the Rodeo, which is also set in Angola. There's a TV and a movie ethos about it. Let's say that, we have like this almost image where it's like Shawshank Redemption, which was set and stuff in the 40s and 50s, and it's almost like a fairy tale mythology we have of it, where it's like, oh, better get in, someone's gonna, do this, and the gangs are all, based on race. It's like, and to a degree they are, and but talking to ex-cons and reading about it, it's like the riots were mostly, it's like a strike. Think of that, workers did a strike there, and they also use it to that time to make booze and trade drugs and all that, and fight for different parts of territory. So when a riot happens, it's never spontaneous. They'll find an excuse, like if a guard beats somebody, down too hard or something, like they might use it. A lot of this is from let's say Les Edgerton. He's a crime writer, older fellow. Sorry, Les, but he is. And he's written some good crime fiction, period. And one was called Just Like That, about two guys who get out of prison for 5 or 10 years. And it just gave the criminal mindset. We have the other thing I wanted to get with the prison scenes is that we have this image, where, someone that's abused his kids or is a rapist or whatever, they're going to prison. It's like, they'll get theirs. They'll get the street justice they deserve there. And it's not really true. If you're weak, and a lot of people who molest kids are these little, skinny little guys who, are going to not do well in prison no matter what they did. And that's why they're getting attacked. And they'll use that excuse on them to try and get out of trouble. If you, beat a child molester to half to death, you're going to say, it's like, I couldn't stand that, and to try to get a leniency from the prison justice system.
I see.
But it's rare that it's true revenge on it.
Because I definitely know more about it from the before they go to prison stuff. Like, I know more about the police procedures and, and that particular part. And one of the things you have is you have the whole elements of good cops and bad cops also. Like, the reason that this guy was a victim, this rapist that Jay goes to prison for is, he was a kid who was well connected. His father is really well connected and stuff. And so the cops situation when Jay comes back and he's out of prison, it's like I was trying to get a read on things. I'm like, I thought these guys were friends. Why do they seem to be threatening him? And it was just all because of this whole like internal police pressure. Like they had to do what this powerful man of the town like needed to be done, kind of a thing.
Well, that's the other thing is they're called peace officers, and so their job is to keep the peace, which may not always be the best thing, for freedom. That's a lot of times where we see suburban police have violent problems, against minorities or anybody. It's because they're looking at something as, they're trying to keep, some sort of order that you may not really be breaking a law. You may be, they might have, more sympathy towards you if you are, not someone they consider an outsider. And, you'd be let go in that case, but when you're considered a troublemaker or an outsider, they're going to, wield the system against you. And that was it. My father was a police officer in Nutley for a brief time. He told me, stories of things that had happened while he was on, the force. And there it was, it's almost become a cliche, You know, but if they can't catch the person who did it, if they get someone who, you know, it's like you probably did something.
Yeah.
Or you, and that was the, you know, the attitude Jay was given, because he was low class. You know, he'd gotten into fights. You know, he was a bit of a, you know, he was a troublemaker. He's not, you know, he's certainly no angel. He's not, you know, out, wasn't out, you know, in a gang or anything at the time when he was a kid, but, you know, they knew that he was going to be trouble. And that was it. If someone's going to take the fall for it, it's going to be him. It's not going to be someone who they consider having a future. And that's similar cases, you know, with, you know, even happening today. And that's, you know, just how it is.
Well, I want to talk about the twins, too. Brendan and Billy, right?
Yeah.
So Brendan is ends up, you know, we discover that Brendan is gay and Billy is not, and Billy goes on to become a cop, though, right?
Yes.
Yeah, he's the one cop that's sort of like, Jay, like, why don't you just, like, leave town, like, get the hell out of here, you know, nobody wants you back. And
he's very pragmatic.
Yeah.
He's not, you know, he's not a Nutley cop. He's in Newark, you know, which he kind of looks down on the small town cops. You know, he wanted to outdo his father, so he went to a bigger, you know, the bigger city, became a detective. And the thing is, he did, you know, he's very brash with Jay. In front of really, once we they finally learn that he is out.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I'm trying not to give the bad cop thing. It's just more he's very cynical. He's seen it all. He's like, nothing good's going to come of this. You know, it's like there's no, you know, if you had a reason to be here, would say, you know, go ahead, but your
family, you know, was gone. Yeah.
That's it. He does not want trouble. And obviously his own family is involved, you know, Billy's. So, right. You know, he wants peace there, but that's where that comes from. He's not like coming in, you know, trying to be the, it's like, I'm the bad cop and we're friends. It's more like, I'm trying to do this for your good, your own good. Nothing good will come of it. And in the end, Billy's kind of right, even though he's a jerk.
Right.
That was, I get a little entertainment out of making, you know, the characters who tend to be, have their heads on straight in the long run, having a really no, you know, Billy has no good way of talking with people. There's a reason he's, you know, at the level he is with the police and won't get any higher. Yeah, you know, he's not somebody you put on television.
Well, the character who's out as gay is Brendan.
Yeah.
And but part of the, like, Brendan has this life of homophobic abuse. And yet there are, you have some other characters in here, and we'll talk about that, you know, that sexual orientation is not black and white. Like, you're not just like one way or the other, that there's this spectrum. And I don't remember if I linked to the article. I think I did. And there's a couple of books written about men who have sex, or, you know, in some regard, even if it's oral sex, men have sex with each other, but will never say that they're gay in any capacity. And it's, you know, sex between straight men. Jane Ward has a book. There's New York Magazine did a piece on it. And they call it stuff like dude sex or bud sex. And
bud sex.
Bud
okay.
sex.
I forgot the
bud. Term. Bud with a D.
Bud. Yeah.
And,
all drink bud too.
That's what I was thinking. I'm like, because they probably are all drinking Budweiser.
It absolves all sins. It's like the holy water for straight white guys.
Probably. That's probably the.
And I mean, it's only sins in their mind. Yeah, I'm not. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I did read all those articles, and I was kind of glad it was, you know, that it was making light, you know, making it to light that there are, you know, people like this. And I'm not going to name the character who,
right?
You know, who is one of these, because it's, yeah, it's a reveal. But anyone who reads about people who are homophobic and what usually happens, yeah, is that, you know, they're often found, you know, to be hiding a secret life. Not all of them, but it's, you know, it's nothing new there.
Yeah.
And that is kind of what these bud sex guys, you think they would do, is like, they might, you know, after this, they might go, you know, they go have, you know, might have go some bud sex, then go have a couple buds and then see, you know, someone who they think is too effeminate, and they might beat him up. Yeah, you know, it's, And to them, there would be no cognitive dissonance there. But to us, we're just looking out and it's like, okay, you must be crazy.
Yeah. I mean, didn't one of them come out last week? I don't think he was actually in Congress, but he was somebody who was helping pass one of these bills, the bathroom bill thing. And it was oh, this so-and-so advisor to the Trump campaign, blah, blah, blah.
So Ralph Story, I can't remember what state, I remember his name, but I don't remember the state. He was in either Oklahoma or one of the ones out in the middle. And he was caught in a hotel room with a 17-year-old boy that he had solicited for sex. And they really covered it. I didn't share a lot of it because the news articles weren't giving a lot of detail. And I don't like to, just put things out until there's charges because it's someone's life you're dealing with. But no, he was definitely, this wasn't, you're having some trouble and you want to talk to your congressman. Well, let's meet someplace quiet and talk. No, he had solicited him for sex. And yeah, he had been, it was anti-trans bills and some other homophobic ones. And it's not a surprise there because to them, they're so strict about this because they're so afraid of their, real life coming out that they want it's not that they're doing it just to put up a front. It's it's almost as if they, think that they blame out homosexuals for them. It's you make it worse. If everyone was just as quiet and afraid and hated themselves like us, mm-hmm. it would be better. It was the attitude that you seem that comes off of these type of guys. I'd read of characters like this. I was what if, to me, it was just, fascinated me to be able to have those same thoughts in your head at the same time. And I wanted to write a character who wasn't just pure evil, who thought he was doing good and who was one of them. And yeah, there's one in the book.
Yeah. And I mentioned before, you have a couple trans women characters and in the prison system, they're, part of those scenes of Jay being there is they, I don't know how they actually manage, but I guess it's through some sort of bribery situation. Right?
It's not the first story. Yeah. There's many, trans in prison who can, cause you can get drugs in.
Yeah.
You can get heroin. There's no problem with getting estrogen.
So he gets his cellmate changed and gets to protect her the sister. And it was just one of those things that when he comes out and meets Raina, he's just kind of hey, it wasn't some big shocking, very loud motorcycles going by. So it wasn't this big thing. Jay's reaction was just so natural. He was just
Well, to him, that was the thing is if, To Jay, this character was always a woman. When he met her in prison, that's how she wanted to be seen, and that was they were cellmates and friends. So, to him, it wasn't a big shock. It was more, that's how she had always presented herself.
Yeah.
And that also comes from my personal life. I've known both trans people who transitioned at work when they, when they came, they were not, dressing. And then we just got, they transitioned while they were employees. And you have to have, empathy. It's not something easy to go through with, seeing everyone around you that. And that they deal with so much crap from society in general. It's people that are around you, close by. You have to, hope that they would at least be, consider it.
That was so sweet. You have these moments of just pure caring and compassion and sweetness, and it's in this book filled with murder and abuse, and how Jay feels. He's this person was just okay, I'm gonna take care of her. And so when she starts dating somebody from that club, he's just okay. And, the whole club scene itself feels so slimy and everything. And
That was tough too. It was more I felt bad putting in a strip club in a crime novel because it's such a cliche, but when I wrote it, I would say, okay, I know people who've danced, you know, and both men and women, and I would say, okay, I'm going to write this from their perspective. I mean, the people like Jay is seeing it as a bouncer and, you know, as a customer, but I was not going to let that facade that the customer gets at these places be there at all. If I wanted to show it from their side where it's, you know, it's work.
Yeah.
And it is slimy and sleazy. I mean,
yeah,
that's it. I mean, yeah.
And it's a business, and sometimes it's an organized crime connection or what have you. You know, so like Jay just gets, he really gets, I don't know if prison was harder or if coming out in his real life then is harder for him.
That's why, yeah, I use that as the conceit was, he could survive the prison yard for so many years, you know, with so many new people coming in who are going to be younger and stronger and have to prove themselves, and, you know, people who are unhinged or you know, think that, you know, they're going to have to prove themselves with violence or not. You know, and it's really just regular life on overdrive. If you go to an office, you know, there's people who, I mean, they're not going to shank you, but they're going to, you know, try to bully you and see where you stand on the pecking order, see where they can push you around, if they can talk over you at a meeting, you know. So I want to make that comparison.
And like I said, you have, you know, these scenes where these, especially like teenage Ramona and Jay together, that are just so sweet and they're so in love and everything's so romantic and adorable. And then you have obviously, like I said, this book that has all this other violence sprinkled in. So as a writer, like how, I don't know, probably because I suck terribly at writing sex scenes, but I'm like, I'm reading this and I'm going, how did he do this? Like did it take like 8 million revisions or, you know, anybody helping you saying, no, this here and this here and this here? Like, how did you do this?
With just the sex scenes you're talking about?
Yeah, and then, like, because you had to transition back and forth between, you know, this brutal stuff and then into these, you know, sweet things. And it didn't come out like porn. Like, none of it came out like porn.
I'm glad it didn't come out like porn. Writing those scenes, I tried to keep it, you know, just little flashes of what, you know, I tried to think of, like, what would you remember if you were a character in this, you know, in this particular scene, or what I would remember. You know, you're not going to have, like, a video camera in your head. And so I thought of it, you know, just keep the minimal. And because, I mean, they're not, you know, there's no euphemism. You know, it's graphic, you know, to a degree, but it's very, you know, it's cut very short, and you know what's going on with the very least being told to you. And to do that, yeah, I try to think of it as looking back and, you know, what memory would take away from you, what would it leave out, and, you know, how to do it without being, say, salacious. You know, you need, sex scenes should always, you know, have a purpose other than just saying, oh, that's hot, you know, unless you're writing, I mean, if you're writing a book that you want to turn people on, that's fine. But in this, it needed to be, you know, stuff that, develop the characters further. And Jay, yeah, if that's where you see Jay's, yeah, his problems, his scars from his past, and also Ramona's. And but I wanted to show that they could still find tenderness together. So it wasn't, you know, like, oh, you know, like, shocking or anything. It was just, you know, two damaged people who had found each other because they fit, and they, you know, they had a short time together.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it's probably not, I don't think it's spelled out or anything in there that Jay is PTSD, but goddamn, he definitely does. And that's,
yeah, good. Okay. I'm glad that got across.
Yeah. Because, that was one of the things that I wrote this long review and like praised you incredibly because you deserve it. One of the things I mentioned was about how other storytellers, sometimes they get the abuse part wrong. Like they just use it as motivation for why is this person seeking revenge, and they don't really show the character. And Jay, like, has he has these nightmares, and he, you know, so he doesn't sleep, and he has intimacy issues, like, physically, and, you know, like, there's just so much going on that, like, sex is not just sex to him. Like, there's, you know, his brain is so overloaded, and, you know, and it's just, like, it was, that's why it was, like, such a relief, like, to see all of these symptoms, and it wasn't, like, spelled out, like, oh, well, now Jay needs therapy. You know, it's like, you just read about him, and it's like, oh, my God, this guy.
Well, yeah.
He's fucked up. He's
well, some of it is, you know, firsthand. You know, I was not abused as a child, but I have gone through traumatic experiences, and I wanted to, write him honestly about it, because I think we get away from that a lot in, especially in the crime and thriller and pulp, where if you're someone who kills people or has been around violence or emotional violence, all their lives, they're going to behave a certain way, not any one certain way, but they're going to be affected. And I don't want him to be like, oh, he drinks a whiskey. Whiskey doesn't solve this. You know, it's like there's so many, characters who are alcoholic because of it. And, Jay, does drink in the book, but he's like a kid because he hasn't drank in so long. You know, he's the cheap date who can get drunk off of one drink. And I didn't want to give him that out. I mean, and he doesn't have many people to talk to. Like, even the people who've, the only person he could was Ramona. And now, like, that they're older, it's on a different pain. But one thing I wanted to go back to, sorry, was when you were talking about the trans characters. And one of the reasons is my great uncle. He ran bars in Manhattan for organized crime back in the 70s. And a lot of them were gay bars that were there were certain ones that were for, meant to be friendly gay. And there were other ones that were more specific for the straight, bud guys who in those days, it wasn't, looking for bud sex. It was, you'd want it, they tended to want either effeminate gay or someone who was transitioning, like a trans woman, because would hire bartenders who were trans. He told the story of one who called herself Betty after Betty Grable, and his story, he told me, which, he grew up on a farm out in the Midwest, and luckily he made it to New York alive, where he could be, where Betty could be what she wanted once she was older. And that story stuck with me, just as I couldn't imagine having to go through that. It's like, it was hard enough, anyone finding, learning who you are and having society look down or think or try to tell you that that's not who you are. It's got to be so difficult in any, thing, but especially, the trans experience. And I was like, I wanted to try to experience in a character, what it was like to have that kind of strength to be able to, live with that. And Raina is that type of strong character, and Jay uses her as that example in when he's, talking to one of the bad guys, who is trying to explain himself and say, it takes us, strength to do this. And he's like, no, you don't know anything about strength. And he tells what he knows of Raina. And that, to me, was one of the scenes that means the most to me, at least.
And and it's got to be so different than when your uncle was running these bars, because, today, I don't want to say it's easy to be out, because it's certainly not. There's so much abuse. They're on, like, I think we've counted, like, 8 just trans women of color murders, and that's just this year, and it's not even the end of March. I think there's more openness and more acceptance as people are learning about like separating what we were taught as science and what's being discovered, and just because it's one of those things where I always kind of wondered, like, who cares if a celebrity came out as gay? Like, I always kind of wondered, like, who cares? And people are like, oh, because you need that. You need, and I was just like, really? I didn't need that. But I guess you kind of do. And so, like, the Wachowskis are, you know, they've, at least Lana, anyway, got the Human Rights Campaign Award and gave this incredibly moving speech a couple years ago. It's great. And, you know, but the people that I follow on Twitter, I follow, like, a decent number of trans people and trans activists and just the whole queer culture. I'm like, oh, you know, it's these people, they're all here for each other. And even, you know, like those of us that are, you know, cisgender, we, you know, we try to be there for them and not burden them or anything and just try to be there and be supportive. And yet I felt so bad. Like, there's this one person that I'm following, and over the last couple of days, like, her Twitter, I wasn't seeing the people that I guess were harassing her, but she was just like, she actually posted, okay, I'm quitting Twitter. And then it was like 10 minutes later, no, fuck you, I'm not quitting Twitter. That's what you want. and she just had like such a bad couple of days of harassment. And
like I said, you can see a lot of support for trans out there too, but there's a lot of, you know, it's the hatred against it has gotten stronger as well. I mean, with the election, yeah. Now there's this bus going around trying to say that, you know, boys are boys and girls are girls. You know, it's like, obviously they'd never heard Lou Reed. Yeah. I mean, yeah, sorry to make, I don't mean to make a joke of it because it isn't funny, but it's like, you know, like 40 years ago, we were toying with this in popular culture, and it was like, we keep forgetting that we can go backwards, and we did. We did in the 80s after Reagan, and we slowly got back a little in the 90s when, you know, we make all these movies where it's, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we were nice to each other? Yeah. And then
I know, that's just it. Like after 9/11, like days after, right after 9/11, everybody was so nice.
Oh gosh, yeah.
It was amazing.
And there were no planes in the sky because
it
you know
was quiet.
Well, you're further out west, but here in near Newark Airport,
it
felt like I was like a child again. There were so many fewer flights, and it's not to glorify 9/11, obviously. I mean,
but it was different.
I was worked in Manhattan that day, and it was it was terrifying. But it was definitely a changing point in the culture as well.
And so now it's like, there's like this immigration bans and the bathroom bills. It's like it's like all of these legal reasons to hate and discriminate, like the Religious Freedom Act. It's like,
which one's that one? I mean,
that one is the one. The religious,
there's some names.
Yeah, that's the one that basically won like the Hobby Lobby case.
Oh gosh.
So that if you're an employer, you have the right to fire people. And some of that makes total sense to me, and some of it doesn't. If you're a Catholic school and you only want to hire Catholic people with your same viewpoint, honestly, I'm like, okay, whatever, it's a Catholic school. But there are gay Catholics, you know, so that's another thing. So it's like, they can write everything off as religious freedom, and then you can, you know, the bakery lawsuit thing was the big one. You know, somebody didn't want to make the cake for lesbians or something, and they were shut down, obviously, because their business, like, I mean, first of all, between all of the hate mail and attention, it's like, well, maybe you just should have made the fucking cake. But now this, so that the Religious Freedom Bill allows people to say, no, I don't want to bake your lesbian cake, you know, which sounds like the cake has sexuality, but you know what I mean.
We are definitely going back with that, with the, you know, the separation of church and state and how we view it. I mean, we can't, I think, thanks to the media fracturing, there's people that are, the words seem to have different definitions to different people of different political stripes.
And that's why, you know, it was so odd. And it was odd, yet, you know, we understand why, that there's class issues and not just gender and sexuality issues. But, you know, Caitlyn Jenner being a Trump supporter and a Republican and his token, if you will. And it's like, how can you support somebody who would tell you you're not allowed to use this bathroom?
Not to be cruel to Caitlyn Jenner in particular, but when is that going to affect her?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's how we see with whites, whether they're rich or poor or whatever, or, you know, there's people who just don't seem to care, you know, about, let's say, the immigration ban and all this. And it's like, well, you're not seeing your family torn apart because of it, or seeing it happen to friends.
Yeah, you're famous enough, or, you know, you have enough money and whatever.
I don't know what to blame the selfishness on.
I don't know.
Because to me, I want other people to be, to feel comfortable and free in my country, as long as they're not hurting other people. You get into arguments all the time because I don't consider myself a libertarian, certain things. Yeah. I mean, I don't, if you want to go out and shoot guns and mm-hmm. keep them locked up and you're safe, keep them safe, go right ahead. I mean, I don't want to compare that to someone's identity. You know, it's not the same, but it seems like we've all gotten into each other's business and are judging. It's almost, like the Puritan, the puritanical impulses of American culture seem to come to head here. And that's even with healthcare, we're seeing,
you
saw this on Twitter the other day where the guys are going like, well, I can't ask the guy to pay for a mammogram or this. It's like, what do you mean you can't? You don't have trouble asking me to pay for a trucker subsidy or something that is not going to help me at all.
Yeah, I'm childless and, taxes would pay for schools. Like, come on, because I don't want stupid children being raised. I mean,
Even that, you're turning it into something that, how it does benefit us. And it's true. Most things that we pay for do.
Right.
Benefit in some way if we get, down to, granularity of it. But it's almost like, well, why should I help someone who's not me?
They don't know where their taxes go.
Okay,
that's just
I can't explain it to you if you're, if you don't have empathy for other people, I don't understand. And part of it is that loss. It was a great book that I read. It's a very depressing book called Strangers in Their Own Land, where a Berkeley sociologist, she went to deep red Louisiana country, like Tea Party country, just to study them and see why they voted the way they did. And there wasn't hatred up front. They didn't talk about it, but essentially, it came down to, people I know work hard and they need the help and everything, but all those other people, ones imaginary people they don't know, or someone who they see who looks different than them, as they're driving by, their house, they consider those people to be late. Oh, they're the ones on welfare and cheating and late,
Right.
And should I help them? And why should I care about them? It's like, I keep getting told I should care about these people and I don't. It's like, well, then why should we care about you when you flood when you lose all your jobs? It's like, it's because we're Americans and we're supposed to care for each other.
Yeah.
We've lost that.
Yeah. I don't know if you saw, because you had a busy morning, if you went on Twitter at all today.
Well, I tried to avoid it.
Try to take a day off or something. But
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I wanted to get a little bit more happiness out of the AHCA Trump Care thing getting defeated. Yeah, so I didn't want to say anything that was going to make me depressed.
Okay, well, there are some great memes and funny quotes and videos to go back to that will make you chuckle. You remember, this was part of my news and social media blackout. There was Pizzagate. And,
oh, God.
And I didn't really know what it was at the time. I was like, what are people talking about? I'm not watching the news. I don't know. And and it was that this nonsense that somehow there was like a child prostitution ring being run by the Clintons or something. Like, it was just so absurd. And it became like, so it was like, it basically like demonized this one pizza shop guy. And who had nothing to do with anything. And it was because that site InfoWars that just makes shit up. They just made something up. They just made it up one day. And police raided this place.
I mean, having dealt with a little bit of crazy forum stuff in my past, I mean, they do make it up. But a lot of it is because they're sitting there in a forum, talking back and forth, looking stuff up.
Yeah.
And any correlation or,
you know, so they sort of, like, string these things together, like, you know, that crazy corkboard thing.
Yes.
And so that's how this happened. So there are people. So this should have been all done and over, right? And we thought we had moved on past this. Today, there's a little protest going on in D.C. I'm not kidding.
This is after they caught the guy who went there with a rifle, and he pled guilty.
Yeah.
People protesting, saying that this stuff's happening.
Yeah. So it's like, it's weird because then they'll be like, you know. Like, people showing up in their Pizzagate t-shirts, and then they'll be like, you know, the one person who's trying to enlighten them with reality, like, it's like, oh, dude, you know, you're outnumbered by the crazy right now.
And you can't disprove the conspiracy.
Yeah.
That's the problem with it, is there's, you know, but it's gotten so bad. Like, I shared an article about a prisoner who had been in Angola, solitary confinement for 44 years, Albert Woodfox.
Oh, yeah, I read that, yeah.
And we're getting short on time, so I won't go into too many details, but I shared, you know, his speech upon release, and someone said, 44 years, that sounds like cruel and unusual punishment. You sure it's not fake news? Yeah, he doesn't exist. So, you know, it's like, what do you mean? Like, how about you Google it? Well, like, now it's like the onus is on everyone else. It's like you share something, and it's, oh, well, prove that this, you know, that's okay. Yeah.
And people believing that the Earth is flat again.
I really hope that some of that is trolling, but I don't know.
I know. I hope so, too. I hope so. I just don't know. But, so that's the crazy-ass place that we're in. And, you know, and thinking of, like, you know, the noir of a small town. And
I can tie it back to it. It's like, because of, the, you know, book and, you know, the anthologies, including Protectors 2, that you have a story in, the great Bessie Coleman story, help fight child abuse by donating to Protect now. I do get a lot of the Pizzagate nuts. Because anytime you mention, you know, a trial of someone who's a child abuser, you know, they tag it with Pizzagate and this and that. It's like, oh, see, there's another one. It's like, they don't all know. It's not like they all have a chip in their head and get orders from the Clintons. There's people who've done this for years. And it's if you wish that the people would take their crazy hatred of, you know, of, let's say, the Clintons or anybody, and put it towards fighting child abuse.
I was wondering, when I was reading your story, because you made the locations real, I was wondering, like, I wonder if any of this had, like, a nugget from real news. Because, yeah, I mean, that's just one of those writer prompt things, you know.
I'll be upfront and honest, yes. There was an axe murder in Nutley that had nothing, that's completely different than what happened in this, in the book, but... There was an axe murder. If you can use Google, I would wait till you read the book. It won't spoil anything, but you might think it does. There was a lot of incidents of bullying that I got directly from the news that inspired the bullying in the story, other than stuff that happened in my real life. We all deal with bullies. We've got one as president right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and then, well, the story about in the park where it's like this... You know, you made these cops legends, where they chased this guy through the park and there was a shootout and stuff. And I was thinking, like, every time that part came up, I was like, God, that sounds so real. And I don't know. I mean, they could be. I mean, there's probably a million stories.
It's an
album,
certain stories of that I know of. It is not any secret truth of. A shooting that did happen in that area or another one. Part of it was based on my father when he was a police officer. He was not involved, but there's a famous police murder in New Jersey. Happened in Lodi. James Trantino, that's the guy. They finally released him from prison. He was one of two armed robbers who robbed a bar and found two police officers there, got the drop on them, and executed them. And when they found those guys, only one of them, Trentino's the one who made it back you know, who went to jail. The story that my father told me, which, like I said, this is just Tim telling me. So I don't know who he heard it from or whatever, was that when they found, they caught Trantino by when they found the first guy, they, the police, really went over, were very violent to him. Let's put it that way. And then took a picture of it and, told them, it's like, if you don't turn yourself in, this is happening to you. I don't have any proof behind that. Like, this is just it could just be locker room talk between, people, but it's a 50-year-old case. And having that in my head, I was, it made me think, it's like, wow. So what is behind all, the stories that, of growing up in this, it definitely had an effect on me.
Okay, yeah, because it did feel like I said, it felt like something very realistic and everything. And I thought that it was just going to be like this sort of just nugget mentioned in the story, but then it just kept coming back and back and back. And then you finally get like the whole story. And I was like, oh, because I was just thinking, oh, that was just like a little tidbit to get to know this guy. And it was, so it was really interesting. Like I said, I loved technically how you put stuff together. So what I should have asked you first was, did you write this just from beginning to end, or did you tackle it as far as chunks of time?
Well, the first draft of this, I'll be real quick, was a NaNoWriMo in 2011. And it was a different character. It was the point of view. Jay did exist, and some of the basics were in there, and some of the, let's say Ramona existed, and Matt and Tony. But I wasn't happy with that draft. I wrote it from Jay's point of view. And at that point, I did try to structure it out. This one, I work better with an outline. I don't always use one for the first draft. Then I go back and put something together. And that's what I did with this, to try to pair up scenes in the past with scenes in the present to help make sense of everything. So, when you meet the characters, okay, who is this Billy guy? It's like, okay. And then directly afterwards, you get to see where they met his kids, and you say, okay. Yeah. And you see him, who he was before, and you get an idea of what must have happened between now and then to change their personality. So, and that was intentional, but it helps a lot to organize with a board. Alexander Sokolov has some good resources online of how to keep track of your three act structure, and that's what I used for this.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. And definitely before you go, I want to know more about what other projects you have going on, because it seems like, I know BoucherCon is coming up and people are already talking about it. So is there going to be another volume of Protect?
Protect. I'm doing another Protect anthology. I loved putting those together, but they are a great amount of work.
Yeah.
The books are doing very well. Together, I think there's 100 writers almost in both of them. One is 41, the other is 55. So there's 96 stories. I think we're good there.
Okay, because I know that you have all the other short stories and other books, your Denny stories and stuff, Denny the Dent stories.
The next book I'm finishing now is also based in suburban New Jersey, and is about two nerds who inherit their father's old man bar and try to make it trendy, and it gets infested by hipsters. A little bit lighter than this, but still, dirty Jersey and crime in there. And after that, I will work on the next J.D. Marteau novel. He's going to Louisiana, and spoilers, he lives. Yeah. when you call it a series of usually, you can assume that the main person's going to live. And looking forward to, setting a book down there. And short story-wise, I don't have a lot coming out this year. I mean, because I concentrated so much on the novel, I have a few stories coming out. One is more horror, which I know I can't give too many details about that, but it's for a Lawrence Block anthology based on It's based on works of art. And ooh. I chose one of my favorite paintings, which is Truth Coming Out of Her Well to Shame Mankind. And hope it lives up to that great title.
That sounds like a really cool book. I mean, especially if Lawrence Block is involved.
Yeah. You should definitely check out, was it In Sunlight or In Shadow, which is an anthology he edited, which all the stories are based on Edward Hopper paintings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the noir, painter, who did Nighthawks at the Diner and, many others. And Megan Abbott has a story in that, too, which is great, because I love Megan's her suburban noir tales, too, her domestic suspense, but she cut her teeth on 40s and 50s era noir as well, and this one is based in a burlesque club in New York in that time, and you can tell that she's just having a blast with it, and I love that story. And it opens the book, so I guess Lawrence Block thought it was great, too.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I was going to ask you for recommendations, so now we've got a couple. Anything else on your radar? I mentioned the Normandy Gold comic. It's
If you like 80s era stuff, Peep Land by Krista Faust and Gary Phillips is another comic out from Hard Case Crime, which I've been enjoying. I'm really glad Hard Case has got their own comic imprint now with Titan and stuff.
Yeah,
I like that. I like another comic I read is Bitch Planet. I'm enjoying that. Kill or Be Killed. Anything by Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips I love too. I'm enjoying Motor Crush, which is a little different for me. That's future motorcycle racing type comic.
I haven't checked it out yet. That's definitely on my radar though. But Helena Crash is a brand new one out that I did a little mini review of. That's, if you like Tank Girl, it's that kind of vibe. But it's sort of noirish because it's dystopian, so it's like in the future and there's aliens and stuff and robots and everything. But it's very noirish where it's like just this like city and there's organized crime and she's just trying to be like a courier, sort of like transporter.
Okay, that sounds cool.
Yeah. So that's definitely on my radar. What about anything TV wise?
Oh,
TV?
I do, but I don't watch as much because of the I need time to write and read, and I read a lot and I write a lot. Lately, TV wise, I watch Underground. Trying to think what's coming. I do have some shows that are ready to record, and I'm trying to remember what's coming up. I'd be really excited in, but I love Stranger Things. It was very, it was a little like a little too many, derivative stuff where it's check marks and all stuff from our childhood. But
yeah, it was very 80s.
Yeah, but your first, for the first season, you gotta grab your audience. So, I think they'll be a little freer next time, to trust that we're gonna like their story. And I loved it, so I'm looking forward to more.
Cool. Yeah, I'm kind of a binge watcher, so I usually wait for
And you've got your book coming out, right?
I do, yeah. I have my final draft done, so got to get the other Tom Boatwright, to work on the cover, because he makes me the most beautiful covers.
Yeah, they are nice.
And and then book 3 will be out.
All right.
That's good. So where can people find you and get your announcements and stuff?
Oh, well, as you know, I'm on Twitter as Thomas Pluck. My website's thomaspluck.com. Bad Boy Boogie is available in bookstores, online, Amazon, the usual places. And I will be doing a few readings and signings coming up in the New York, New Jersey area. Nora at the Bar in New York on the 2nd. You can find this all on my website under events. So I don't expect you to remember it from a podcast really quickly. But there'll be signings in both New York and New Jersey. I'm heading out to California. Thank goodness for frequent flyer miles. Doing Nora at the Bar LA with our mutual friend Dwayne Swierczynski. So that's going to be awesome. I love Dwayne. I've never read with him before. So hopefully I won't go right after him.
Yeah. Well, it'll be fun. I guarantee you, it'll be fun.
Yeah. And hitting a few other crime cons this year. Thankfully, I've been slugging at it for 5 years now, and my name's gotten around, and I'll be at BoucherCon in Toronto and Murder and Mayhem in Milwaukee in November, and cannot wait.
Oh, is that the one where they do like the Crime Academy thing? Like, there was one, I think that was it, where I was reading where there's an actual guy with like, I'm not sure if he's specifically only a writer or what it was, but he actually teaches writers about police procedure.
Oh, there might be. This is my first time going to that one, so we'll see. But I know there are a few crime writers who are ex-police and could definitely tell you.
Yeah, it might be like a different event or something, but I think that's, you know, it's probably tied to that or something. Sounds really cool. I don't know if I might get to Deadly Ink again.
I'm trying to hear back from them. I'd like to go just as a reader as well, but I'm trying to see if I can get on a panel for that in June, and hopefully. So, okay. I mean, hopefully I'll see you there.
Yeah, that would be really cool. But that's, you know, that's good. So to follow on Twitter and website and stuff, Bad Boy Boogie is the name of the book once again. It's getting glowing reviews, like I said, as it deserves. And yeah, absolutely. So if you have any questions, you can, you know, track both of us down and we will direct you to the place to get the answer. And wonderful. I can't wait for your hipster bar book because that sounds like fun.
And great. Yeah. Well, then I'll definitely make sure I get to edits tonight. Just put it off.
Yeah, no putting it off. No putting it off. I mean, I busted my butt so that I could watch the new Grace and Frankie season.
Yeah.
That was my reward for finishing my final draft.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah, Sarah watches. I haven't watched the season, but I've caught episodes, and I love Lily Tomlin. And, yes. Yeah. So. She's great.
She's amazing. She's absolutely amazing. So I will let you go then because I do not want to come between you and your work. You guys can follow me. What was that?
So thank you so much for having me here. It's been great to talk to you again. It's been too long.
It has. It has. So, so guys, follow me on Twitter at Elizabeth Amber because even though it's been really political of late, I do still talk about books and comics and stuff like that and nerdy things and you know, fundraisers, and I try to, you know, make sure I mention other people's Patreons, make sure I mention charities that need, you know, some attention. So that's at Elizabeth Amber. Everything else is at amberunmasked.com, and you can sponsor the show at patreon.com/amberunmasked. So have a good one, Tom.
You too.